Hello. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Trials and Tribulations of Using Music Online. Today we're going to discuss copyright, licensing, and royalties for music use on the web, and that includes podcasting, vlogging, blogging, and internet radio, websites, etc. I'd like to begin by introducing myself. My name is Elise Nordling, and I'm from San Francisco, where I'm the marketing services manager for IOTA, and I manage a website called IOTA Promonet, which licenses music for blog and podcast use. And I'm also the music director and DJ for Indie Pop Rocks on Soma FM. Yeah. And I have a very long and varied history in the music industry, from record shop girl to editor and music writer, et cetera. I'm gonna start down on the end. At the very end, we have Chris McDonald. Chris McDonald is the founder of IndieFeed Networks, which is one of the most successful podcasting services. They deliver over 2.3 million downloads a month. He's also the chairman for the Association of Downloadable Media, which is located at downloadablemedia.org, which works with members such as Microsoft, Apple, Turner Broadcasting, and Nokia. And they help monetize episodic downloadable material. He's also the executive vice president of business development and operations for Libsyn, which is a media delivery and advertising insertion solution for medium and large businesses, such as the National Geographic Society and NPR. And he is from Washington, D.C. Next up, we have Rusty Hodge. Rusty is the founder and general manager of Soma FM, which is one of the largest independent internet broadcasters, and they currently have 13 radio stations. He's also the music director for several of Soma FM's channels, including Groove Salad. And before the internet, Rusty was creating podcast-like shows that were accessed by calling a special phone number. He later became involved with computers as communication tools for broadcast and multimedia, and was helping get radio and TV stations on the web. He's also located in San Francisco.
He's also a really great guy.
After that, we have Rich Bengloff. Rich joined A2IM as its president in January of 2007. He serves as a board member representing independent music label community on the boards of the Sound Exchange and the Alliance of Artists and Recording Companies, otherwise known as the AARC. He spent much of his career in the music and entertainment industry, having served in various capacities at Sony. He's also the vice president of Columbia Pictures Entertainment as vice president, finance and administration of Relativity Records and RED Distribution, and as vice president, distributions operations for Sony Music Distribution between 89 and 98. He then joined the Elektra Entertainment Group to become senior vice president and CFO, and in 2005 he became WNYC Radio's vice president of finance and administration. And then finally, I have Brian Zisk. Brian Zisk is a serial entrepreneur and technology industry consultant specializing in digital media, web broadcasting, and distribution technologies. He created the San Fran Music Summit, where the digital thought leaders in the music technology space come together to do business. He is a co-founder and technologies director of the Future of Music Coalition. And additionally, he is a board member for strategic advisor for a wide variety of tech companies and nonprofits, including Music Brains and Ziff. So welcome, everybody. I'm going to go ahead and dive right in because we have a really large amount of material to cover in a very short period of time, and I want to make sure we have plenty of time for questions and answers. So I'm going to start with copyright. Brian, will you go ahead and explain how there's two different copyrights for any recording?
Well, basically, there are two kinds of copyrights for every recording. there are the person who wrote the song, and there's the person who performed the song. And really, very often, they're not the same person, but you have to make sure you have licenses for both sides of the song in order to be able to perform it. Now, there are various, you know, organizations to get the different licenses from, or sometimes you have to get them from the individuals, or sometimes it's a compulsory, and we're going to be covering that.
Well, what exactly are the two different copyrights? Like, what are they for?
Well, one is for the sound recording, basically, when you perform it, you know, you fix it into a tangible medium, and that's the person who performed it. And then there's the composition, which is, you know, the songwriter or the person who created the music, or sometimes there are two separate people who will share the copyright, but those are the two, the people who wrote the song and the people who performed the song.
You know, the way I always look at it is the writer is the one that created the song, and then the performer brings it to life.
Sure. So, which copyrights do you need clearance for various uses on the internet, and why is it important?
Get right
all
in there.
Of them.
All of them.
Well, just to clarify, there's certain rights that are statutory, and then there's certain rights that need to be negotiated. So when I talk about a statutory right, that means the government has decided what the amount will be paid, and you don't need to get anyone's permission. So, for example, on the internet, when someone's webcasting streams, like Rusty Station, Soma FM, he's streaming music, and there was a rate set by the Copyright Royalty Board in Washington after a hearing that decided what the rate should be, and Rusty or anyone could stream that music. He doesn't have to go to the performers. As long as he pays the rate that the government set.
We can use any music that is publicly released.
Yes, he can do whatever he wants. And then you have these social networks that are out there now, like Lala and iMeme. And what they're doing is music on demand. You go to their site and you decide what you're going to listen to. In Rusty's case, he decides what people are going to listen to. At a site like Lala, you go and you say, yeah, I heard a little bit about that song. Let me listen to it. So now the consumer's making the decision. For that music, Lala has to get a license. That's not covered. And you may say, why isn't that covered? A stream is covered, but an on-demand isn't. Why? Because that's what the government decided.
And it probably also has to do with usage. When you're going to, I think one of the arguments for the different royalty rates for those sort of things is when you're listening to a radio station where a DJ or a programmer is picking the music to play for you versus playing stuff on demand, you're not going to be as likely to buy the music for yourself if you can hear it anytime you want to. So if you're using a music service like Lala, or I guess Rhapsody would fall under that category, you know, there's a lot of argument that you don't need to buy the music at that point. You're just, you know, you can play it whenever you want by paying a fee to these services. Whereas there's for the music like a typical radio station would do, be it over the air or online, you're not able to hear the song whenever you want. It's up to the music programmer to decide when he's going to play it for you. Then you get into this gray area of these customizable music services. This is where some of the copyright gets a little strange, because you would know the, I think, Brian, you know the details on this. Like with a company like Pandora, they've got a lot of limitations on what they can play. You can customize your stream, but you can't exactly pick what you're going to hear. You can say, like, oh, I want to hear music like the Eagles, and it'll come up and maybe play you a Don
Henley probably song. Shouldn't talk about Pandora, because they're kind of in a gray area that
I just want to point out that those kind of services are in a gray area right now. Yeah.
But currently they don't need to get licenses, is the current interpretation. So they
only according to the ruling in New York State, but that's arguable.
We're not going to argue. Well, maybe we will argue today. although I'll probably blunt the argument by saying that doesn't mean the rates that the government set are fair. So, for example, Sound Exchange, which as Elise said, I'm on the board of directors of Sound Exchange, gave their position on behalf of artists and record labels as to what the rates should be. And on the other side, DEMA, who represents people like Pandora and Yahoo and AOL and a variety of webcasters, gave a position of what they thought the rates should be. Soma FM and they're a class of smaller webcasters, AccuRadio in Chicago gave a AccuRadio, excuse me, did I say weather?
No.
And AccuRadio gave a position, and the CRB came out with rates. And as you heard, my background is financial, you know, and even though I'm on the Sound Exchange board and we won, and actually I don't think we did. From my position, I don't know, I'm not sure we won as an independent. Those rates are too high. So we continue to negotiate right now to come up with something that's fair and reasonable. You know,
of course, webcasters want it to be as cheap and low as possible. And, you know, Sound Exchange wants artists to make a bunch of money. So,
I hope you'll be there at my panel. I was told to butt in on this when this topic came up. We're going to have
let me say something though, Rusty. And we're all friends. But
at least now.
Yeah. At least until 4. But there's been a change in consumer consumption patterns. Okay? That's why the CD has gone from selling 14.5 million units in 1999 net of returns, and this year when the RIAA puts out its statistics, it's going to be 8 million. That's just, again, sales of CDs. Some of that's been made up by digital, whether it be through mobile, whether it be through iTunes and other download services like Amazon, whether it be from subscription services like Rhapsody. But it's not making it up. The industry in total went from 14.6 billion down its last year, 2007, it's going to come out approximately $10.5 billion.
But who says the recording industry has the right to make as much money as they did before?
Well, Brian, all I'm saying is there's a change in consumption patterns. Music resonates in people's lives as much as it ever did, or we wouldn't all be at South by Southwest or all the other conferences that I go to.
I think it's also safe
it's
to say...
I'll let you finish later. It's just their consumption patterns have changed from a purchase model to a listening model. As you said, they can go on demand to La La or iMeme and pick the songs that they want to listen to. Even in yours, and don't get me wrong, one of the reasons I think the CRB rates are too high, that we agree on, is it really opens the door for independent music labels. Independent music labels really don't get played on your traditional over-the-air terrestrial radio because independent labels don't have the money to hire independent promoters. They don't have regional promotion staffs. There's too many barriers to entry, even including bands like Evanescence and Nickelback. Those are all independent, on independent labels. They're bigger hits, and I can name a number of others. Tim McGraw. It's still under 10% of listening in the United States. Last year in 2007, thanks to these good people, independent music for the non-terrestrial, when I'm talking about non-terrestrial, I'm talking about Soma FM, I'm talking about AOL, talking about Pandora, I'm talking about XM and Sirius, satellite radio, I'm talking about music choice on your cable television set. Anything that's not over the air, that's coming in either through your computer or your television or something else. Last year it was 39% independent music. Think about that.
Yay.
Under 10% to 39%. And it's because people want independent music. And last year, and these aren't, well, those are Sound Exchange statistics, which they did give me permission to share at these conferences. But in addition to that, there's public surveys like Bridge Research. You know, confirms that the number last year was between 18 and 19% of listening has now moved to the non-terrestrial things I mentioned, away from, actually over-the-air radio stayed the same, the audience is actually growing, but the non-terrestrial, webcasting, satellite radio, will grow to be approximately 40% sometime in the period between 2010 and 2011. The barriers are coming down. People are getting access to the music they want to hear as opposed to what a programmer wants to, either because it's taking it away from a Clear Channel or a CBS, or it's someone like Rusty, he can add another channel to meet consumer need. He has 12, 13.
Yeah, 13, yeah.
13, but
it, and it's all niche stuff that you it's niche programming you wouldn't hear over the air.
But if another genre came out,
yeah,
it was popular,
you
would add a 14.
If we see another type of music getting a critical mass around it, and we start finding a lot of artists putting out music in that similar vein, it's like, okay, that's time for us to launch a new channel. I wanted to say something. We do want to see artists get paid for their music. We're not out there pushing for all music to be free. We want artists to be able to make some money off their music. They don't necessarily need to become multimillionaires, but they should be able to make a good income off their music to focus on creating more music. We want to encourage art and rewarding artists for creating art, because that's the only way you get more good art in the future. So I want to clarify, there are some other internet radio broadcasters and stuff who are like, oh, artists make too much money, they should just give all their music away for free, and they'll make it up on selling t-shirts, and that's not my point of view.
So there's even a much greater bunch of issues that we really want to cover. I was asked to plug my panel, which is resolving the webcasting issues. It's at 11 o'clock. I forget if it's tomorrow, one of these days for music.
It's on Friday.
It's on Friday.
In
she knows
room
better.
15.
And we've got a nice lineup there. I'll be the moderator. We've got two webcasters, and then we have one ex-Sound Exchange attorney and three current Sound Exchange attorneys. So that's a nice balanced panel, so I'm sure we'll work it all out right there. But I hope everyone from this panel will be in attendance because
hopefully
you all
that'll
have
offset the imbalance of this panel.
Yes, it'll be wonderful.
Representing the artists and the
yes.
labels.
But okay. But we really appreciate your view on the rates as a Sound Exchange board member because yes. that's not really presented publicly as the Sound Exchange opinion. All on Friday.
Okay. So I'm going to lasso you guys back in again. Sorry. It's time to talk about licensing and why you need different types of licenses and for what types of use. And Chris, I was hoping you could explain to us what sync licensing is and when you need it.
Okay, so I'll first start by saying we don't use sync licensing at IndieFeed. So it's an audio show. But what sync licensing is in a nutshell is the synchronization of the audio track, the artist content to a, in most cases, a video. Scenario, whether it's a movie or a television. And as we talked, there are statutory rates for some of these rights. Sync rights happen to be some of the most difficult, high-friction transactions today associated with music rights. Because
you could say, I want to use a song, I want to press 100 copies, they could come back and say, you have to pay us $15,000, and that's within their rights. And God forbid you put it out before you clear it, because then it's a lot more than that.
So explain, like, if, say, I have a vlog and I decide I want to use a song that I found on the internet and put it in there, can I just do it or do I have to get sync licensing first?
For a blog, you mean a video blog?
Yeah.
Ostensibly, by the rule of law, you do. You have to negotiate with a rights holder and who wishes to send it out. There's other types of kind of copylefts that much of you have heard about that would preclude that sort of that necessity, but it's within the rights of the rights holders to negotiate those sorts of fees. And generally what happens, and again, not an expert here in this particular area, but generally what happens is, you know, you've got a documentarian who might be having a show about some, you know, very kind of non or tangential subject matter, and in the background someone's singing a song, and you know, you could actually have a rights holder. You have to get all that stuff cleared. So if you want to talk the film component of this show, of this event, there's a lot of kind of headaches associated with that. So
this is why if you buy the DVD of WKRP in Cincinnati, all the songs that were integral to the plot line have been excised.
They're redacted, essentially.
And so, you would need to do a sync license if you mentioned with a even just a video blog, if it's just you, hey, you know, I'm reading my blog and you're playing a piece of music behind you, you need a sync license there, as well as if it was a, you know, a short film you were putting together, or I'm assuming even if it's like a flash animation.
Yeah, a flash animation or a slideshow, you know, even anything where there's actually picture being synchronized with music, you do need that licensing. Yeah. But there are some places on the internet where there's music available that's already cleared for that use. Can any of you guys talk about that?
Who wants to talk? Creative Commons stuff?
Well, for one thing, I was going to say that the practical reality, let's get out of the licensing conversation for just a second. The practical reality is if you're not making money off of this content, if you're not monetizing in any way, it's highly unlikely that someone's going to try to, you know, seek a injunction or some cease and desist unless it's having a negative impact on their brand or what they own.
Well, you might get a DMCA takedown notice, or your ISP might get a DMCA takedown notice. Right. That's probably the worst thing that would happen.
To Elise's point, there's creativecommons.org. It's a resource that everyone should at least be familiar with. It allows for rights holders to select from a range of different options associated with how they'd like their work to be distributed. The idea being, if you pre-permit certain activities, then you can have more free distribution. So for an example, you could have a piece of content that you want to maintain certain rights with, but you want to grant others the right to distribute. So long as you attribute, for example, as long as you say that it's from the rights holder. And then you can get into a whole discussion about layered rights. At IndieFeed, we have, you know, obviously tracks that other people own, and we've come into this. So we have our own content, which is, quote, copyright, what we speak about when we're referring the content. But we also want to make sure that when you're mashing stuff up, that you're not impinging or stepping on the toes of the actual content.
There are also a number of other sites like Production Tracks or Rumblefish, which make it really easy to go on and just, get a license for music cheaply and quickly, and those are really good solutions.
Yeah, Magnatune is another one that provides like sync licenses as well. And what about if you want to use music for podcasts and you don't want to license it, but you want to find some of the music that's pre-cleared for it? Then
yeah, so here's the thing with podcasting. Podcastings are downloads. They're actual files that are distributed. A lot of people might suggest that they're a lot like a radio show because you got a girl or a guy talking about activities, and then they go into a song, come back and talk again. Sounds a lot like radio, but what the practical reality is that these are bits that are coming down in a download portable format, generally free for use in an MP3 format. So that invokes a whole other type of licensing. It's called a mechanical rights license. It's a component of publishing, and a lot of the large major labels have rights that are bartered, and in cases, I believe, they have ownership rights mm-hmm. with those through large companies like Harry Fox. So this is the way this worked. It came from a long history of music rights, starting way back with player pianos, I believe. But the idea being that if you're going to mechanically produce something, CD, a vinyl, you need
piano
to...
roll.
Yeah, it's come to the point where the government has created what are called a compulsory fee license schedule that actually charges, 9.5 cents per download. So what that means for podcasters and for artists is if you don't have rights cleared content, you could be potentially liable for that as if it was, a copy of the CD. So you got to be very, very careful.
And that fee is per song per download.
Exactly. So
you can imagine, you put 10 songs in a podcast, and it's almost 90.
I think we owe probably about $3 billion if there was not rights cleared music. So the point is, you got to make sure you get that stuff. As an artist and as a creator, there's ways to work around that. Obviously, you may not have a relationship with Harry Fox. It remains to be seen how publishers, we know exactly how it's seen, how publishers relate to this. They feel that it's something that's monetizable and should be paid. But the reality is that there's way, and as a result, it's one of the reasons there's a lot of crap podcast audio shows, and that the music is sometimes not at the high standard because you can't get that really great new content that's out by a major label. But as we know, there's a lot of great indie music, and we've managed to work on that particular
niche. Can you talk about where you can find cleared music for podcasts?
That's funny you say that. You can actually find it where she works. There's a place called Independent Online Distribution Alliance, which is a network. It's an organization that has relationships with major indie labels. You can get them there. There are directories and deposits where you, as an artist, could submit your music for the use and distribution. I believe there's a company, Podshow, has a directory as well.
Because if the artist does own all their rights, like they haven't signed their rights over to a record label or a publishing company or whatever, they can directly grant you the rights, but it's impossible to manage a lot of different artists like that. So you want to work with somebody who's acting as a clearinghouse, and that's where IOTA's PromoNet or...
Well, be careful, too. You want to make sure that the clearinghouse isn't, by virtue of trying to make it easy legally for them to be able to operate, that they're not unduly restricting your rights. So, for example, the company I just named, Podshow, if you take a look at their EULA and you really cared about your music rights, you probably wouldn't submit it because I think it strips prospect performance royalties as well as mechanical rights. And there's still a very vibrant discussion as to whether performance rights even apply in podcasting, but you're still stripping those rights. So you got to be very careful about who you're bargaining with.
As a musician, be extra careful of situations where if you give up certain rights, you don't get paid, but everybody else who gets used in the same way does get paid.
Mm. That's very important. One of the things that most concerns me about artists and labels right now is when there's a statutory law, like we just described earlier, that when Rusty plays music on his 13 stations, he's allowed to because he doesn't have to negotiate it, that it's a statutory rate, one that's too high, I agree.
But I'm glad I don't have to negotiate.
Every so often, there are people who are out there right now over the last couple of years that I've been involved in my current role, who go to labels and artists and ask them to waive their statutory right, which just makes me, you'll make it up in promotion. An industry that went from $14.6 billion down to $10.5 billion. By the way, if you take that 14.6 from 1999 and index it, so it's in current dollars using a consumer price index, so you can compare it to 2007, they've gone from 18.1, the music industry's gone from 18.1 billion down to 10.5 billion. We've lost 42% of the industry.
But there's a compromise here. There, you could take your 12 songs within a track, 12 tracks within a CD and say, you know, there's one of these that I really want to distribute and I want everybody to know about it and, you know, quote, give it away, strip, not even strip the rights. Well, you can negotiate rates where you say, hey, listen, for this fixed period of time, and this piece of time, during the time we want to break the music, there's ways that you can contractually negotiate to make sure that that is out there and safe and people feel comfortable, the bloggers feel comfortable putting the stuff up, because a lot of people do care about making sure that they're, the assets that they're investing in their own micro networks, they're doing it the right way.
But Chris, I'm not disagreeing with that, I'm sorry. I agree with you in terms of what I'm saying is they're going to artists and labels and asking them to sign blanket.
Yeah. Clear Channel was doing this.
I worked on that. Clear Channel wanted any independent artist or independent label to waive their rights. Actually, we'll get into ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC in a minute. To waive their statutory rights for the royalty they get for radio play. And you had to hit the little button when you submitted your MP3 to be able to do that. They've since taken that off their website.
After a lot of pressure from people. But
we worked together on that.
It was a kind of bad thing, because if you're a little band and you do submit something and they play it on one of their online shows and it becomes a big hit, and then suddenly it's like a top 50 song, which is not impossible to imagine, then you're losing out on all these royalties you would get for your over-the-air airplay.
Yeah, which, again, the industry shifting from a purchase consumption model, consumer tastes, to a listening model, but we have no problem with doing of short duration.
We should start talking, because I haven't seen a lot of major labels take that route, and there's still a tremendous amount of friction.
Yeah, well,
and as a result,
those the independent labels.
Well, yeah, good. We should talk more.
but it's really troublesome to us. The promotion's not working when you lose 42% of your industry over an 8-year period.
The other thing a podcaster needs to be aware of, if you are using these songs that are licensed for limited periods of time, you've got to remember to take your podcast down after a period of time. Because a lot of people put up content and, you know, oh, maybe the show was just for this week and it was only up for that week, but it's still living on the net. It's on your web servers. People are still downloading it. You know, you see podcasts that, you know, were published 2 years ago that are still, you know, accessible on those podcasting aggregation sites like Odeo and whatnot.
And if there's a breaking band and a major label takes it and there's new contracts, and you may not know the contracts, but they're still out there and they're still binding, the moment that download occurs, you could still be found liable for a kind of infringing copyright.
So keeping track of like the expiration dates on the content that you have limited rights to use when you're going to use it in a podcast.
Chris, can I ask one more quick question about podcasting before we move on to royalties? What happens when you have a podcast but it's mostly being streamed on the internet? Do you then fall under performance royalties?
So I can imagine a couple cases where that would be the case. And so is everyone comfortable with the notion of streaming versus downloading? Is there anything we need to kind of go into that? Okay. So here someone says there's no difference, right?
Who said that?
It's just bits,
obviously,
right?
You're not a lawyer.
Somebody cares that there's no difference. So can you give me a little
not
bit of what your kind of thinking is? It's the same?
Just the intent.
Yeah. So today there's technology that will actually negate the distinction. But let's talk about just the basics. Downloadable content, you this portable. It's the bits are transferable generally outside of the device in an MP3 form usually. With a stream, it's generally tethered. You know, it's usually it's a desktop experience. You generally can't get at that content unless you're smart like he and his dad. As a result, there's a whole body of legal discussion, and you guys are experiencing it much more, because we're not really at the target at this point. about what these things are. And that's where the Pandora discussion comes in, because the legal distinctions start to play around how much control the consumer has with the relationship of what they're consuming. In a radio station, you don't have any control except for turning the channel. But with a download, you can choose it on a site that just has one of a variety of different downloads, and then there's these hybrids.
Yeah, so MP3s are progressive. So what I think what Paul was saying is, even when you're downloading an MP3, you can play it as it's coming, in which case it's a stream. So it really comes back to the intent of the whole thing, which is actually, I think, the biggest problem that podcasts have with licensing, because in reality, they're just a stream on demand. But because the intent with the name is first you take it and you put it on your computer, and then you take it and you put it on your iPod, because you know that from the name. You're talking about multiple reproductions instead of what in actuality is a much easier to license stream.
Yeah, and where they care about it, and you can take it and put it on your peer-to-peer network, where you can replicate it, you know, hundreds of thousands of times.
The other thing about streams is, like, in general with a stream, you can't, like, you hear a song you like, you can't back up and hear it again. Whereas with the podcast, you basically you can skip ahead, skip behind. Podcast is kind of like, you know, a TiVo version of a TV show.
Where it's a captured stream.
Yeah, it's a captured stream. But with a
not a download.
So it's that's not a that, stream.
Yeah. Right.
Sorry.
But anyway, it's about the access. So, you know, the idea is, like, you know, it's a copy when you can do a lot more with it. This is from the intent point of view, not from the technical side of view.
So it's a thought crime.
It's a cliche. A stream, you're basically taking what is being sent to you. You don't have the provision to, like, you know, repeat it again or skip ahead to something you don't like.
So these are fairly smart people, and we still can't get our stories straight. So imagine how long this is going to take.
It's going to take years for this to get dealt with.
Years?
So
I have a quick centuries.
Right, should we take some questions?
Well, no, we're going to move into royalties briefly first, okay, and then we'll take questions. Sorry. I want to discuss what are the differences. There's two different major bodies of royalty collectors. One of them is ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC, and then the other one is the Sound Exchange. Rich, will you just, like, briefly outline what the two different bodies are, and then...
Sure. It's funny. You have to really go back in the music industry to really understand it. So when I was a little boy in the 1920s and 1930s, the way radio used to work was music was played live in the studio. A band would come in, and they would play music. There wasn't a lot of music being sold at that time. You know, vinyl didn't exist. There were cylinders. I remember, you know, I used to look at them. And
wax.
And
putting them on player pianos.
So, yeah, exactly. So the writers of the music weren't getting compensated. The performers actually were getting compensated, not on a statutory basis, but they would hire the performers for 3 hours just like they would get money to play a club. So nothing was set up for the performance, as we defined before. There's the writer and there's the performer. The writer writing the song, the performer bringing it to life. So ASCAP was formed back then, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. And they're a non-for-profit, and they're owned by the artists. You know, the people who wrote the music own it. And, you know, they manage it, they elect a board, and it does it. A number of years went by, and they'd negotiate on an annual basis with the radio stations as to how much should be paid. It was a pool of money for what was paid on the radio. About 20 years went by, and the radio stations weren't happy with the way things were going, so they created BMI. Most people don't know it, but the radio stations own BMI. How many people here knew that?
And it stands for Broadcast Music Incorporated, correct?
Yeah.
Largely in response to ASCAP not allowing music they considered race music to sign up for the royalties.
Yeah but also to try to keep the rate down that they were paying everybody else as well. So they perform BMI, and it's also a not-for-profit, though, but it's sort of the radio stations on both sides of the negotiations now. CSAC's much smaller. It started off in Europe. It's the Society of European Stage Authors.
If you play gospel music, you need a CSAC license.
CSAC. Or country music.
And they also have a lot of Hispanic music, Latin music. And then they have selected artists they gave big advances, like Neil Diamond is signed up with them. Bob Dylan is signed up with them.
So they
My
could
son
sue
was very
when you
upset
don't
in
have
college
a license.
because the college he went to only had an ASCAP and BMI license.
We
so
just
he wasn't
had a
able
run
to,
in over that, too.
So he wasn't able to play Dylan. So there's three different of the, they're called performance rights organizations, and the writers sign with one of those to make sure they get their money. The three of them go in every year, every 2 years with the radio stations, and they just they negotiate a bucket of money. In this country, it's about $450 million that gets distributed to the songwriters. It's really expanded, though. It's wherever music is performed. So it's for radio play not only in this country, that's the number I just threw out there, but also from overseas, which is almost the same number. American music's one of our best exports, right? You know, not just in English-speaking countries. You know, if you're chanteuse like Natalie Merchant, you're played in France. If you're a heavy metal band or a rock band, you're played in Germany along with David Hasselhoff. But also, when you go to a concert hall, there's a blanket license charge. When you go to a bar, they have to pay an annual amount for that jukebox. If you go to a retail store, if their primary business isn't music, so for example, Waterloo here in Austin, their business is selling music, so they don't have to buy a license. Virgin Records, their business is primarily music, they don't have to buy a license. Then there's disputes with Barnes & Noble and Borders. They're saying it's one of their primary businesses, and these PROs, performance rights organizations, said, no, your business is books. You should be paying us. So if you notice, or selling coffee. So if you notice, if you go into Barnes & Noble, you don't hear music anymore. They just pulled it out and said, the hell with it. We're not going to give you guys money to promote your music. It's a lot of money when you add it all up, all these different sources. It actually comes to over $1.5 billion that gets distributed when you add in the domestic and the foreign and all these sources. They get a little carried away. They went after the Girl Scouts about 5 years ago.
A little carried away?
Because they were singing Happy Birthday, which is a copyrighted song. It's not in the public domain.
Is that ASCAP or BMI?
I think it was, I always blame the radio stations.
Okay.
Nonetheless, working with them is a walk in the park as opposed to licensing each track individually.
Yes. Yeah, I actually don't have major problems with most of the things they do.
I find that CSAC was the one that was the hardest to work with, but after going back and forth with them over some stuff, we finally came up with, oh, well, you would also qualify for this other license, which turned out to be completely competitive. And I'm like, well, why didn't you mention that the first time? Yeah. And because the initial license they were showing us was aimed at like a website that has very little music and very few listeners to a radio station and has a much lower minimum fee. But then when you do as much listeners as we do, it was ridiculous. It was going to be like 10 times what we're paying ASCAP or BMI. So finally I got the guy to, I said, no, that's ridiculous. It doesn't make sense. He goes, oh, well, how about this license? So if you're going to negotiate with CSAC and you see, think the rates you're getting, or actually with anybody you're high, ask them if there's other available licenses, describe what they're doing. Because a lot of times you're just talking to a salesperson initially whose job is to go out and find places that are using music without a license and then say, hey, you got to get a license.
By the way, ASCAP and BMI are not-for-profit. CSAC is a for-profit entity. They're in the business to make money, where the other ones just get their overhead reimbursed for 8, 9%, and 90-some-odd percent gets
15%, right? 15%?
They're very different. The radio stations have a higher admin than the ASCAP people.
To briefly take the counter-revolutionary position, this discussion kind of makes my eyes bleed. Because I have a real hard time, you know, kind of working through all of these different license scenarios. And there's a particularly good book about, it's called The Future of Music, right? Where it kind of posits this world in which we start to look at music more like a utility does. It looks at water. And you know, you don't necessarily pay a different rate when you drink your water than when you bathe with it. So, you know, I hope in the next few years, if we can get through this morass, we can actually get to something a little more simpler for artists, and especially, you know, to help the folks distribute.
Well, it's funny because you're right. There's an agency called Harry Fox that has nothing to do with the online space, but they collect for sales of music in stores. There's a certain amount. They represent the publishers to make sure when someone does a cover of someone else's song, that someone gets played. So if Blackie from Urge Overkill does a cover of a Neil Diamond song like he did in Pulp Fiction, they make sure that Neil Diamond gets the money for that, or UB40 doing a Neil Diamond song, or whatever it may be. There's just a lot of agencies in the U.S. In the U.K., there's one PPL, one-stop shopping. It's a much better way to live, so I agree with your...
And we're absolutely not getting into the issue of what happens if someone from another country accesses your music from America.
Yeah,
because that would take like 4 weeks.
Sound Exchange, which I'm on the board of, represents not the writers. We represent the performers who bring the music to life. We really just deal in the non-terrestrial space, webcasting, satellite radio, music choice on your cable. Deal with podcasts. It's sort of, that's one of those Netherland things that probably pisses Chris off. So right now we really just deal in the non-terrestrial world, and we make sure that the performers get paid more often than not statutory amounts. There are no collections for traditional terrestrial radio over the air. You know, you're
at this time.
At this time, that's another panel that I'm on. Thursday at 11:45, if you want to come here, about that injustice and how the artists aren't being compensated.
That was briefly mentioned in the panel before this one, too.
So explain, at what time do like Last.fm or YouTube pay someone like Sound Exchange or BMI?
After the folks come after them.
Boy, that's a long discussion. They haven't really settled so far with the writers. It's going on in Washington right now what to give the writers. What they're giving the performers is an advertising share. Or they're offering. They're saying whatever advertising, you know, the banners or whatever, or the background, you know, that pops up when you're looking at your computer, there's a fingerprinting technology so they know how many clicks and what songs people are listening to.
That's a Rolling Stone song. That one we don't recognize. We won't pay that indie artist.
Well, they have some problems with their technology, and I'm certainly not going to defend them today. But they are trying to fingerprint all the music. They are.
So who is Lala making that deal with? You know, like.
Well, it's not statutory. Remember I told you there's statutory and there's negotiated. Frankly, a year ago, Lala and iMeme and Last.fm weren't paying independent labels. They'd go to the four majors, they'd make a deal, and then they'd move on. Now, this year, they've started doing the independents, quite frankly, through my organization, because we can message about 13% of the market. Independents are about 30% of the market. And what I find is our newsletters get passed around outside our membership as well. So they're signing people up. They're willing to pay independents now, which maybe they weren't a year ago. But it's hard to find 4,000 labels.
Yeah. And even with those fingerprinting technologies, you've got to basically prime those fingerprinting technologies. So like if it's a really obscure piece of independently released music that, you know, someone put behind their video on YouTube or they're playing
on Soma FM.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The fingerprinting systems aren't going to find it. By the way, if you release music independently, make sure, and you put them out on MP3s, make sure your ID tags are completely filled out and accurate.
Definitely.
All these record labels send us MP3s of stuff they're promoting and want us to play, and their ID3 tags say, like, track one. And that's it.
And whoever registered that is making bank.
I honestly believe, I honestly believe at this point they're trying to do the right thing, all these people that we're mentioning. A year ago they asked labels and artists to waive their rights to the independents. They're not going around asking for that anymore. Instead, now they're trying to get deals, and they're willing to give 50-50 revenue splits, which is the same thing that they're giving at least to three of the four majors, except for the 10,000-pound gorilla who tries to get more. No, there aren't, but in some cases the majors aren't getting advances as well. In some cases they're giving the 10,000-pound gorilla major a minimum per stream in addition to against the revenue, you know, the greater of a minimum.
And weren't there some equity deals involved too?
Yes. There's one of the majors that's the largest major that's extracting benefits, I won't mention them. Who's extracting equity, who's extracting per stream minimum, saying, we'll do an advertising split, but if our music, if we multiply it out by the statutory rates for streams, and that ends up being more, we want to be paid that. They're not giving that to all four of the majors. And I honestly believe they're trying to treat us fairly and equitably. There have been monies. In some cases, I've signed non-disclosure agreements, so I really can't share them. So
oh, come on.
All right, it's time to open the panel up for questions. There's a microphone in the middle of the aisle. Please use it. Thank you.
Hey, how are you?
Hey.
Question about tethered downloads and whether there's a mechanical due, is there a statutory rate? What are people doing? What are they, I guess, to explain, and what are people doing about them?
Can you clarify tethered downloads? Yeah. Your ones like those are ones that have DRM protections behind them that expire at a certain time.
Sure. Yeah, I mean that would be a good example.
They're not covered by a statutory.
Not yet. That's one of the things that's being covered now in Washington with all the other rates that are going there. Again, they've agreed to pay the PROs at some point for the songwriters. Yeah.
How many years ago did they agree?
5 years ago.
Okay. It'll be settled any century now.
So technology is moving so much faster than the legal stuff behind
I'm
it.
I'm not going to defend them.
I'm not going to ask you to.
But I want to get paid, too.
Yeah.
That's basically what I thought. So, I was wondering if there had been any recent headway or anything like that.
Well, it's going on in Washington right now.
I believe it actually moved to litigation at this point after 5 years of good faith negotiations.
But there are hearings going on in Washington for what rates are going to be going forward for digital transmissions, for the traditional CD sales, for tethered downloads, for a variety of things around the table in these hearings that are going on now. So, well, it has been 5 years.
Yeah. Anytime you get politicians and judges deciding the value of music, God help us all.
Back in the day, if I wanted to share a song I liked with a friend, I would just maybe play the track for them on the CD. Nowadays, if I want to share a song with my friends, it may be a slightly wider group, but you know, I'll just post it to my blog. The methods you've described to make sure I'm doing that legally, I guess I can only call ridiculously complex. Given that I don't have several years to get up to speed on, you know, oh my God, what if somebody streamed it as opposed to downloaded it and they stopped the stream halfway through? Where do you see this going? Is there going to be a simplified way for people like me to do the right thing and legally share a song with other people?
No.
Simply?
No. I think the reason that's not going to happen, not that I would love to see that happen, but there's rooms for abuse there. You're sharing it just with your friends, right? But when you were playing a CD for your friends, you're not able to invite 100,000 people over to your house to listen to that CD.
You're all my friends.
You know, now, I think what may happen, there may be something that happens where there is some free limited sharing. Like you can let, you know, 20 other people hear this song one time or something like that. That may happen. But as far as, like, you know, just being able to put up a song on your blog for your friends with them without paying any licensing for it, not with stuff that's released and not with stuff by established artists.
I shared it with 20 friends, and they shared it with 20 friends. And
well, you can kind of do that now with companies like, I'll put another plug for Promonet with IOTA. We work with them on stuff. So Promonet will put up materials, and that's
iotapromonet.com.
Oh, iotapromonet.com. Okay, not promo.net. That's some other spam site.
I have information cards with me. But
anyway, so they pre-clear all this stuff for use in blogs.
But it's not Britney Spears. No, I know that's not your stuff, but I'm just saying.
Although Promonet is interesting. Promonet gets some more in-the-middle stuff. It's not like complete, really do-it-yourself indie. It's like indies that these guys are going to be famous like next year, or they have a small cult following now.
All of them?
Frank Black tracks there. There's Arts and Crafts label stuff. There's some great music in that collection.
IOTA Promenet's got a lot of electronic artists and stuff on it as well, dance music.
If you want to use music for free, make it yourself.
And then the practical reality is the powers that be are probably more willing to look askance, you know, and not necessarily litigate. Doesn't put you in a very good position, maybe, but if you want to be in the right side of the law. But the reality is, if you're not making money for it, I don't see the point in worrying too much.
The other
about
thing
it.
That may happen is there may be some blogging services that may put blanket licenses in place for music. I think you're already starting to see that now. I mean, effectively, like MySpace is doing that.
I've been hearing that there's been talks.
Yeah, and iMeme is doing it, right. So those kind of things will come up. But if you want to have like an independent blog and put whatever music you want on it, it's going to be a while before there's one central agency that clears it for everything.
But okay. But there are a bunch who have like kind of rates preset, and if you want to use it, it's like $5 or something like that. I mean, there's like a bunch of folks like that.
Next question, please.
So you talked about music from the audio standpoint. What about music video? And is that going to be like another panel this long to cover that as well?
Way more complicated.
Okay. Yeah, it's way. That's the synchronization licenses we talked on earlier.
But in terms of like the music video for the music, the song itself.
Yeah, so some labels feel perfectly comfortable with negotiating and saying, hey, these are assets. We own these assets. They're valuable. So XYZ website, let's do a deal. You pay us to allow us to put this stuff on your site.
So there's no statutory or any sort of regulation?
It's all negotiated.
Thank you.
All right, next question.
I'm like nervous because you're my friend. So here's what I've heard, and I have a question in response. That we're sort of redefining consumption to include the value of individual experience and leaving that answer in the hand of politicians, lawmakers, essentially, that the essential root that you began talking about at the beginning was that law was made, sort of like the Torah, where it was decided, right? So suddenly there's multi-million dollar industries.
John Simpson is no Moses.
Well, I mean, okay. So suddenly there's three multi-million dollar industries, politics, music, and technology. In music, you have marketing, promotions, creation of the music, employment for artists. In politics, they make laws, and they have all their own crazy, messed up ways of doing it, but it's politics. That's why it's called politics. Technology, which is like innovation that grows out of some sort of superior, sometimes academic achievement, like from ENIAC to the iPhone, right? So who are the politicians in charge? Are there any representatives from any area of those three industries representing, are they being lobbied by any industry? Are those industries working together in any way? Are there any organizations that bring those industries together to lobby the politicians? And who are the politicians that are creating this next round of laws that are going to decide copyright rights?
I'd just like to jump in for a second.
Sorry.
The music industry is a very small industry of $10.5 billion. To put it into perspective, Verizon Wireless does $100 billion. That's just one of the wireless companies, right? So we're sort of a boutique industry, a very important industry, and everyone tries to rip off our music to sell their phone. Like when you watch the phone ad, it makes me crazy. You start off with my five friends, my six friends, however many it is, and the next thing that they go to is either sports or music. You know, whenever you watch, for whichever one of these are. When these rates are set that we described earlier, it's a hearing. Everyone gets to put in their position. And, you know, music is on one side, and Yahoo and AOL and everyone else were on the other side. So the good guys won. The little $10 billion industry beat the hundreds of billion dollar industries of the Microsofts and the Yahoos and the AOLs. Absolutely.
But I've already said
it's unfair. But if it wasn't a statutory, then no one would be getting any money because you have to force them to pay or they're going to find a way around giving compensating writers and performers, and they're going to get them to waive their rights and they're going to lean all over them. So to me, having a statutory rate is better than just letting a free market. Because then you'll have people like Professor Lessig, or the guy at the end of the panel who sounded like him for about 2 minutes, decide that music should be ubiquitous and available, and individual artists should decide whatever they want to do. And if it gets to that, music's just going to keep shrinking, and artists aren't going to be able to
see. The RIAA has a really good strategy. They hire legislative aides for $500,000 a year, and then all the current legislative aides angle for that gig. So when they go and push their agenda, they have all these people kissing their ass to get the RIAA's agenda passed. And that's part of why it's all out of balance.
The amount the RIAA spends versus what the Microsofts and the AOLs and Yahoo spend is a fraction.
Not regarding music. Regarding music, the RIAA spends way more.
It just seems that it should be a panel, that it should be people making the decision and like a technology representative that's super valuable, like Einstein or Picasso, or representatives from the actual industries that are affected directly by the law. So I was just wondering, are there any?
You got the RIAA on one side, okay. You also have Sound Exchange, who's acting like the RIAA on that side.
Music first.
You've got folks like DEMA who are representing, you know, whoever's paying DEMA. You've got A2IM, which is representing the smaller labels. Who else? I mean, there's really not. There really aren't the artists in the mix. I know at the Future of Music Coalition, we're not a lobbying organization, but what happens is we get, the legislature comes to us and says, we got these guys want this, and there's all this money. These guys want this, and there's all this money. What do the artists think? And we're like, artists are like cats. They think what, you know.
if you go on the website for Sound Exchange, and I'm so tired of hearing RIAA controlled. The independent labels have 3 seats.
Right.
The RIAA has 6 seats.
Right.
And the artists have 9 seats.
But according to John Simpson, their biggest customers are the labels, and those who they are who they have to answer to.
Last time I did my math, if you took 9 label seats and added the 3 independent music seats,
are those appointed seats
or
are those elected seats?
Versus the RIAA only has 6.
But then why wouldn't you just settle? Because obviously it's the RIAA folks who are pulling the strings.
No, that's actually not the case. There's some artist groups that have not agreed that the rates are too high.
Like who?
I'm not sharing with you.
Yeah.
I have to work with them.
Yeah.
Go ahead. What's the next question?
Let's go to the next question, please.
Okay, I'm going to scale this down.
Just try.
We're going to talk quietly. People level. I have a friend who has a video podcast. It's definitely not me. this friend has a video podcast where you can get to know indie rockers, like interviews with indie rockers talking about ordinary stuff. And the podcasts feature 30-second clips of them performing their music. They sign they sign an agreement that I can use everything. I mean, my friend.
Can you clarify, when you say a 30-second clip of them performing the music, is the podcast recording that? Who acquired that 30-second bit of them performing?
I did at the show.
Okay, so you videoed. Okay.
Yeah. So they sign a release before the thing to use everything, and then I videotape, use about 30 seconds of it. The site is a showcase to promote indie rockers. You can buy all their CDs right on the page, little bio, the whole thing. But I've been very under the radar in terms of how many people know about me.
You mean your friend?
And my friend. I'm out. It's me.
Let it go. Embrace yourself.
I've been very under the radar in terms of the scale of the people. I'm talking to, little Brooklyn bands that nobody's heard of. But
yet.
Some of those little, exactly. And, you haven't heard of me yet, but you're gonna. So I'd like you to speak to 2 things. One is the rights of live performance, where it's, the performer's performing, but it's not the recording that you hear on the radio. 2, is there some sort of license that is a blanket license that covers promotion or something that would be accessible to a little individual not making any money from the site?
Let me ask for one more point of clarification. Are the songs they're performing songs that they wrote themselves, or
yes,
are they doing cover songs?
No, it's their music.
Okay.
You're probably okay. You may be remiss in not structuring the right permissions. Okay, so let's assume that these individual artists own all of their rights and they're coming to you fully and they want to do a deal with you. You just want to make sure you probably have spend your $1,000, $1,500, try to work with an attorney to make sure that the rights document you have encourages, the right stuff. So what you're talking really about is a sync rights, and you're talking about also performance royalties associated with those. I'd posit that with podcasting, you don't pay performance royalties. There's many people who will disagree with me, and those people who do it, and it's a great idea to cover, since there's a blanket rate. You could pay the $300, $400 a month, or a year rather, and get that covered as well. I believe that's a sliding scale. They do negotiate those rates, and they try to make them easy. So, but I'll be the first to tell you, I don't think it gets you anything. So your best bet, in my opinion, is to make sure you have an attorney, and I could refer you to one who can help you with a document.
But in general, what you're saying, if the band owns, if the band owns their music, like they are the ones who wrote the songs, and they haven't licensed that to another publishing company, and you are recording the video of them performing live, then basically what you're doing is fine. If they're doing cover songs, that gets into another area, but as long as they've they're performing songs they wrote.
You're in the clear as long as no one notices. Now, one of the, like, the ugly things that's happening now are venues are actually claiming that they have the rights to the video, to whatever's recorded in their venues. And that hasn't been litigated, but it's actually really ugly. And then the other thing that you kind of...
venues, though, right? That's like...
Well, whatever. If a right's a right. The other thing you touched on was the 30-second snippets. And that is something that people believe is absolutely legal, but by letter of the law is not necessarily so. So just hope no one notices.
All right. We're out of time, but my panelists will be hanging out here in this area.
Actually, I want to, if anyone's with a record label as opposed to an individual artist, you can go to a2im.org, not com, to find out about our organization. I have little cards here that have the address on it if anybody's interested.
And if there's, are there evaluation forms here?
Oh, yes. And please fill out an evaluation of the panel. We'd really appreciate it. Thank you so much.